Support for Quality of Life comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.
This is Quality of Life, Valley Public Radio's look at the people and the issues affecting the way we live in the San Joaquin Valley. Here is your host, Joe Moore.
Well, hello and welcome to Quality of Life for Tuesday, March 22nd, 2011. California's cities have been hit hard in recent years. The housing bust, the economic downturn, and perennial state budget crises are just a few of the factors that have helped batter the balance sheets of municipalities up and down the Golden State. Valley cities are no exception, especially given the region's perennially high levels of unemployment, even in so-called good times. Many large cities like Fresno have been forced to make drastic cuts to city services and have laid off hundreds of employees. But what about the Valley's smaller cities, those in rural areas that have less diversified economies, less margin for error, and already rely on doing more with less? In a few minutes, we'll talk with several community leaders from small Valley cities and find out how they're dealing with the economic crisis. But first, we take a look at one small Valley town where poor fiscal decisions and ambitious plans collided with the sinking economy, shaking the community to its core. Last year, the city went into default on a $5.9 million bond to help build a new city hall in Chowchilla, a move that led some city leaders to consider drastic measures, including disincorporation. Valley Public Radio's Tracy Sharman reports.
Driving north on Highway 99 from Fresno lies one of the most unique small towns in the Central Valley. The city is best known for the kidnapping of 26 children and their bus driver 35 years ago.
The children are all right, the driver is all right. These words ended one of the most bizarre incidents in the history of the Central Valley.
After being denied parole recently, the men who committed the crime are still behind bars. Chowchilla is also home to 8,000 female inmates, who make up almost half of the city's residents. But while the prison population is booming, the city of Chowchilla is financially busted. The housing bubble in Chowchilla popped with great devastation. In addition to foreclosures, the decline in property values greatly affected tax revenues, as City Finance Director Wayne Padilla explains.
The logic was sound in the sense that market value is currently well below what a number of properties were being assessed at. There needed to be an adjustment. They did a very poor job of creating that adjustment, and we feel that it cost all the agencies more revenue than it really should have.
But that's not all that costs the city more than it should have. The city's financial position has been incorrect for years, and Padilla, who's been the finance director since 2009, is currently correcting financial statements with the help of a new accounting firm.
But suddenly, with a $500,000 adjustment to remove misrepresented receivables and now $800,000 to take out a cash transfer that never should have been made, I have no reserve. I've gone negative.
The prior city administrator, Nancy Redd, was put on paid administrative leave in the summer of 2009 after the council found out she had signed documents for her husband's local business to get a government-funded loan, even though it was a conflict of interest. When she announced her retirement,
she actually had a contract, and that allowed her to be paid out for her unused leave. The golden handshake that she referred to, what it was a retirement incentive. It was not part of the CalPERS retirement program. What the city did was they agreed to essentially provide an annuity outside of CalPERS.
Criminal charges were never filed against the prior finance director or the city administrator.
No, there's no criminal charges because you can't sue for stupid. What we found, that we didn't find that the money was taken, but clearly significant errors in judgment existed when these actions were taken, and clearly the council wasn't informed as to what was happening.
The city had to access the bond reserve account to make payments, and as soon as they tapped into that, the bonds went into technical default.
But if they were to look back at our condition leading up to July of 2010, they're saying, where in the heck did this come from? Everything was rosy. You guys were fat, dumb, and happy with lots of cash.
The city reduced staff from 82 to 47 city employees. City employees outside of public safety have taken a 10% pay cut, and the city of Chowchilla has reached out to the county of Madera to share some services. Councilmember Jim Kopshiver explains.
If someone wanted to process a building permit or a project, we have a county staff person that is here at the city hall. When there's no project going on, that person does work for the county.
The council also put their police department services up for bid last week and looked at a proposal from Madera Sheriff Department to take over policing in Chowchilla. But ultimately, the council decided to keep their own police force while further reducing it. Of the 481 cities in California, Chowchilla is not alone in this financial crisis. The city of Vallejo, which is 30 miles from San Francisco, filed bankruptcy in 2008. Councilmember Kopshiver.
We have contracted with or employed the same attorney, law firm that is currently handling Vallejo.
Vallejo will pay over $8 million in attorney fees, and it turns out bankruptcy only allowed them to restructure $50 million of the $225 million that they owe.
We've already analyzed, and for many legal reasons, we cannot walk away from our debt. A bankruptcy court will not allow us to do that.
Chowchilla has considered drastic measures, even disincorporating the city.
Disincorporation was one of those, and we talked about it. What if we disincorporated? What does that mean? Disincorporation, I don't think, is viable. I don't think it makes much sense. The law states that if we disincorporated, we would have to find somebody to take over that debt. Well, who's going to take over the debt? The county's not going to do that. They're not going to assume that debt.
Like most small cities across California, their city council is only part-time, and council members appoint the mayor on an annual basis. The five-member council each waived their $300 monthly stipend this year and have been creative in getting people from the community involved in closing the budget gap. The city sends out flyers with garbage bills asking residents to trim weeds in alleyways and has volunteers taking care of the Little League field because they just don't have the staff to maintain the facilities. Aside from regular maintenance, the city council and Mayor David Alexander have reached out to the community on bigger economic issues.
We have a community ad hoc budget, so we brought 11 members of the community that are reviewing and analyzing budget to create ideas.
Despite the community involvement, the mayor knows it's going to take more than volunteers to get their financial house in order.
The reality of it is as much as our bargaining groups give back, the retirement programs and the health care contributions are breaking cities, and that's going to change here in Chowchilla.
Union negotiations start this week. The city wants to continue furloughs and pay freezes and would like employees to consider paying more for retirement and health care benefits. But as finance director Wayne Padilla notes, there's no quick fix.
We will get through this. Problem for us is it's going to be several years of recovery. It's not like we have a major chain and they just need to begin selling at their prior levels of retail volume to help bring us back. We're largely going to have to do this on our own.
The city is counting on their new management, along with revamping local government business practices to ensure the city's survival. They will also be looking to their volunteer ad hoc budget committee for suggestions.
And ultimately, they're going to decide whether we're worthy of a tax measure going on the ballot to help finance our future operations and get us out of this.
Closing an ever-changing deficit in excess of $1 million won't be easy. For Quality of Life, I'm Tracy Sharman.
Well, I was born in a small town, and I live in a small town.
You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. Reporter Tracy Sharman joins us now in studio. And Tracy, the challenges that cities face are not unique to Chowchilla, but it seems that Chowchilla's decisions in the past had some bearing on their current financial mess, namely in this decision back in 2007 to construct this new City Hall building. How much of this problem is attributed to that?
I don't know. I looked into their bond debt prior to the City Hall building, and it was even higher than it is today. So they were at a time of boom when they made that decision. The old City Hall only fit 60 people. The floors were leaky. So there was a lot of factors. You know, hindsight's 20/20.
And also, the city of Chowchilla has seen a number of issues come up this past week. The city's Ford dealer. There's two major auto dealers right on Highway 99 in the city in Madera County, and one of them filed for Chapter 7 bankruptcy last week. As we talked about on Quality of Life a few weeks ago on our Proposition 13 program, sales tax revenue from things like auto malls, auto dealerships is a big contributor to local cities. How much of Chowchilla's current financial mess can be attributed to something like Bob Silva Ford going out of business?
That's huge. Their sales tax revenue is actually down 15% to revenues less than 2005 numbers. So, I think a lot of Mustangs and Camaros help pay for that community, and it's hard to see them go. So I know they're going to feel that.
Is there still optimism in Chowchilla, though?
Absolutely. The people there love Chowchilla. They have a great deal of respect. They're looking at it as with a lot of healthy skepticism and trying to get it back on its feet.
And the talk of disincorporation, it's no longer on the table at this point?
It seems like everything's still on the table because they're still trying to wade their way through this. But it seems like they have a plan. They have a five-year plan that they're working on, and they seem to be really optimistic about getting the city back on track.
Well, thank you very much for that report, Tracy. This is Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio, and we're talking about the future of the Valley's small cities. Chowchilla, just one of those that we chose to look at. And now we're going to turn to the phones and talk to some other city leaders of small rural communities in the San Joaquin Valley. And we have on the phone right now the city manager of Firebaugh, Jose Antonio Ramirez. Mr. Ramirez, welcome to Quality of Life.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure to be on your guys' show. Thank you for the invite.
And we also have on the phone from the city of Wasco, Danny Brown, the economic development director for that city. Mr. Brown, welcome to Quality of Life.
Good morning, Joe. How are you?
Just fine. And we thank you both for joining us to give our listeners your perspectives on the challenges facing your communities. Let's start with City Manager Ramirez from Firebaugh. What's the current state of your city in terms of dealing with the economic crisis that all California cities are facing?
Well, yeah, Joe. Well, as you know, we've had a series of compound crises. If it's not one thing, it's another. But what we did is we basically took this bull by the horn and we said, you know, we need to diversify out here, and we understand that agriculture will always be the backbone of our community. And so when we were facing, you know, in the early 1990s, all these issues with regard to land retirement, and then this wave of, chronic water crisis, and then, you know, the economy and the housing issues and all that, we knew that we needed to do quite a bit of things out here in order to ride this wave. And so far, we've been blessed from the standpoint that we've been able to ride the wave. And one of the ways that we diversified was, number one, that we needed to address one of our biggest issues in this community, which is our infrastructure. And if we hadn't done that, we wouldn't be able to, grow the companies that we currently have and keep them, and then do a little bit of fishing outside in the ocean and bringing, some companies internationally. And so fortunately for us, we've been able to bring three different international companies in the area. We actually have a company that manufactures irrigation tape and nozzles and all that, and so they're taking advantage of some of the stresses out here, and they opened up here, and so they manufacture all that stuff here in Firebaugh. We were also lucky enough to get a company, and a lot of people don't know this, but we're actually manufacturing some, building some helicopters here. The majority of these are purchased outside of the U.S., but they're being built here. The other one, and that's Hiller Aircraft, and the other one is we have Olam International from Singapore. And so our unemployment was up as high as 40% when, you know, we were getting 0% water allocation out here. And we've been able to knock that down to about 23-24%. So we're actually doing a lot better than some of our neighboring communities. And that was, one, because we came together as a community, all the different, the school, the colleges, the social clubs, and the city, and we focused on diversification. And I have more to share, but I wanted to stop here.
And now let's turn to Danny Brown, the economic development director from Wasco. Tell us what your city is facing in the same regard, the economic challenges and the ongoing challenges of economic development here in the Valley.
Well, I think the ongoing challenges with economic development in California as a whole is taking a pretty large hit. In the Central Valley, we're actually viewed, and ironically enough, even outside of California, people recognize that if you're going to do business in California, the Central Valley is the best place to do that. We have we just have all the good factors that industry looks for. You know, we have available workforce, we have quality of life, in that we have a low cost of living here. You can not buy a house anywhere in California for the price you can here in the Central Valley. There are some challenges, as we heard, and one of the things that we've been very good at doing the last several years is actually taking the stance that the immediate hit to our economy, every community in California is taking a large hit, whether it be from the state or whether it be in sales tax or whatever the case is, especially with property taxes. But we've gone out there and tried to expand our retail base, and our retail base has actually done pretty well, and that's actually helped us sustain. We haven't gained anything, but we haven't lost a whole lot. We would like it to be a whole lot better than what it is now. But it's a challenge to recruit, and we're actively and aggressively recruiting, whether it be the national firms or the international firms into Wasco. We know that the agriculture base that we have gives us an opportunity to go out there and seek a value-added component to our economy, whether it be an interrelated processing facility for some of our crops that we produce here, where we can shorten the supply chain and provide an extra value. But not only that, but also long-term and value-added jobs here for our local citizens as well.
You mentioned the retail base. In fact, both of you mentioned retail and the challenges there. Is leakage, that term that the economists use, your residents going to the larger city to spend their money to buy the goods and services that they look for and want at the big stores, is that a particular challenge for small communities such as Wasco and Firebaugh? I'll let Mr. Brown take that to open up.
Retail leakage is absolutely a biggest threat to our retail structure here. We have a downtown area that's anywhere from 80 to 100 years old, and the problem with the smaller downtown area is that we have a highway literally 7 blocks to the north, and that highway is becoming our main corridor, and it's arbitrarily becoming our quasi-downtown, and a lot of our threats to our downtown area, they rely on through traffic to come in to sell or to buy their goods, to spend their dollars. With everything focusing more so on the highway here, we have Highway 46 as our main highway corridor through here. That's given us, one, a kind of a problem for our downtown, but two, it's also given us an ability to go out there and market to the national to the national brands that, you know, hey, look, we have a traffic counts here that are going up and up and up. We have hopefully a future expansion of Highway 46 coming through here, because that allows more traffic to come through. And our current leakage, I mean, that's the biggest threat we have. We're losing well in excess of 65% of all of our tax dollars spent to, well, in our case, it's the Bakersfield MSA.
And City Manager Ramirez from Firebaugh, how does that issue impact your city in terms of sales tax dollars leaving your community?
Well, you know, for us out here, it's 78%, and so leakage is our number one target, our number one, everything that we're doing, all of our efforts are aimed at curbing that, because that is certainly hurting us big time. And like I said, we've made the turn, and we've been just recently, next month, you're going to see AutoZone opening up here in our community. So we have AutoZone, and we're working on finalizing a deal with McDonald's, and I know that's going to help us bring in some other national retailers. And we also are working with CVS right now and trying to lure them into this community. And that's because we addressed all of our other issues, you know, our water distribution lines, both our water and sewer issues, and then are also addressing, you know, the aesthetics of the community, you know, first-time impressions. So we did all of those things first, and now we're in a great position where we're leveraging, you know, some of our local funding to try to attract these national companies, and we've been successful in doing that. And so I know that you know, they make about a $1.5 million in sales that AutoZone is projecting is going to directly translate into a healthier general fund for our community. So we're very, very excited.
We're talking about the future of the Valley's small rural communities here on Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio, and we'd like to know what you, our listeners, think. What attracts you to a small town? If you live in a small town, we'd love to hear from you. You can call us right now at 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. You can email us at talk@kvpr.org. We are talking with Jose Antonio Ramirez, the city manager of Firebaugh, and Danny Brown, the economic development director for the city of Wasco. Both of you mentioned things that relate to quality of life. You mentioned the downtowns, the small town way of life. How much does that factor into your community's as an asset, something that attracts people or makes people want to live in the small town? And I'll let City Manager Ramirez open up.
Yes. Well, let me tell you, we're very blessed from the standpoint that we're nestled up against the San Joaquin River here. And so we value the river and we look at it as a jewel. And so a lot of things that we're doing here is really trying to leverage that big resource that we have here. So we've created quite a few trails along the river. We a 7-acre community garden where 75 families get to go out there at no cost, cultivate the soil there, and we provide them with free technical assistance and also free water for them to grow their organic crops, et cetera. And then you tie that into, the overall points of connection to the river, so we're promoting the what you call a blue trail, so that they use the river more, and then also we started a Preserve America Commission, so that we can talk about the long valued history that we have here. So all of those things are helping improve the quality of life of our community, and that's why we're up to 7,549 people as of this last census, and so we don't have a declination of a population. It's actually increasing.
And I understand Wasco is growing as well. Mr. Brown.
Yes, that's correct. We're actually, our most recent numbers that came out just recently were 25,545, I believe was our actual number. And that's, in the last decade, that's represents about a 40% increase in population for the city of Wasco.
Now, I want to turn to more fiscal matters now. We all have heard about the ongoing budget crisis in Sacramento and the challenges that cities face. How has that impacted your cities and your small cities already? You don't have the massive staffs to cut that maybe Bakersfield or Fresno or Merced, some of the larger communities may have. You already have employees who are wearing many hats. How does that impact city services and your ability to operate? And I'll start with City Manager Ramirez.
Well, it directly, I mean, all of that, those are all threats for us here. And so one of the things that we were, specifically the redevelopment side of things, I mean, we actually did a lot of fighting back in 2003, and we were successful in extending the life of a redevelopment agency from a couple of years to 30 years, and then raised the cap from 40 to 100. And then we actually annexed 92.46 acres additionally and had a new project area. So all of that was in tune to our overall vision of what we wanted to do. And so now we built it up that high, and we were attracting these national companies and acquiring some property to assemble properties for these folks that we want to attract. And now the threat of losing it, so we've been scrambling here trying to figure out ways to, and pressure our legislature to leave the redevelopment agencies alone, that, this is what's creating jobs, and we show them proof of that, what everything we're doing here. And so you're absolutely right. We are, we're wearing a lot of different hats, what's important here is that our employees understand that we all have to tighten up our belts and that we need to stay together and ride this wave, because better days will come, and we are already way ahead of the game because we're bringing in all these different retailers into town.
And Mr. Brown, how has the economy affected Wasco? How has the state budget affected Wasco and your ability to provide services already with a relatively small base of employment in terms of city services?
I'm going to echo what Mr. Ramirez said about our redevelopment agency. Our redevelopment agency has been the number one incubator for local job creation and growth in Wasco. We've actually used our redevelopment agency, and our redevelopment agency is very forward-thinking as well, and they've used the ability to leverage funds. Being in California, it's tough enough to develop some sort of incentives to go out there and market, especially nationally, internationally even more so. We're up against challenges from states like Colorado, Texas, and any other state in the Midwest that has, whether it be tax increment financing or that they have an economic development sales tax attached to their local community. Texas's 4A and 4B is a good indicator of that, and they can literally develop millions of dollars every year for just economic development activities, and they're very successful in doing so, and as such, that's of course, the largest growing region in the entire country, they were impacted less than any other state during the current recession we're going under. Our redevelopment agency being more interested, and a lot of communities have started different programs through the redevelopment agency, and one of the things we did was a facade program, especially for our downtown area, to where we can financially assist some of the businesses that are here that may not have, you know, they're somewhat strapped for cash anyway, so we were able to go in there and leverage the ability to go through and do a complete overhaul of the front end of their business, and that's increased the foot traffic in some of those areas. The problem with that is we're just hitting the tip of the iceberg with that, and with them proposing, meaning the state of California, proposing to take the redevelopment agencies and eliminate them wholesale, that's completely affecting our ability to go out there and assist our existing businesses, much less attract some of the newer, more exciting models that aren't currently in our communities to help develop a broader tax base. Because, as you said before, you know, our leakage is a main problem. Our services have actually not been impacted too much. We're pretty well set, but we have experienced a reduction in city staffing because of the tough economic times.
You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. Today we're talking about the impact of the economy on the Valley's small rural cities. And go to the phones now and bring on Mike Dozier. He is the director of the Office of Community and Economic Development at Fresno State, which is rolling out a new program called the Rural Development Center. Mike, welcome to Quality of Life.
Thanks, Joe.
Tell us a little more about what the Rural Development Center aims to do in providing resources to some of these small cities throughout the valley.
Well, the economy's hit the rural areas just like it's hit any of the rest of the valley. It wasn't, as I'm sure Jose, Antonio, and Danny can tell you, it wasn't in the best of shape before the economy. And staff expertise has always been an issue because there just aren't the funds to be able to hire the staff that they need to do some of the more intricate work of running a municipality.
Give us an example of that, if you can.
What's that?
Give us an example of what you're talking about in terms of expertise in what sort of areas.
Well, in areas of affordable housing, you'll have in a larger city, you'll have maybe three or four staff members that are dealing with affordable housing. Same with economic development, same with planning. In the smaller cities, the rural areas, they'd be lucky to have one person that does all things. And I think Jose Antonio, in working with him in Fireball and all the good work he does out there, they just don't have the staff to be able to handle a huge workload. And so when there's an expertise or if there's an issue that comes down, let's say SB 375 issues, how do they deal with those when they don't have somebody that's looking at that on a regular basis? What we've tried to do is put together as many experts as possible into a clearinghouse, if you will, so that when there's an issue that's experienced by the rural areas, they can come to us and then we can give them an initial opinion, similar to what a staff would do. I call it a mezzanine consulting service. So it's that bridge between when you actually want to go forward with a project and hire a consultant to do it and the area where you're trying to figure out what's the best way to go. And we've put together about 20 partners, both on-campus and off-campus partners, nonprofits and departments of the university, that will provide that service. And depending on what the community needs, it's geared towards those communities, 50,000 population and below. And so what we're trying to do is be that clearinghouse so that they would come to us and then we would go out to our partners and say, okay, who can help WASCO? Who can help Fireball on this particular issue? And we've been out to speak with Jose Antonio out in Fireball, and he's doing some good stuff out there. And there's a couple of our partners that are working with him right now.
Now, when does this program roll out?
It's rolled out. We did a soft launch because, number one, we don't have a financing or a funding stream other than the university. We have a number of grants that we're in that we have submitted. We believe that we're going to be getting. We also have a couple of private sector businesses that are looking to potentially fund us. And really, the different partners, most of them are self-funded anyway. And so the only thing that's really not funded at this point is the administrative or our office. But we have other funding sources that we're dedicating to it and moving forward. So it's a launch right now. We haven't done a great deal of advertising or marketing on it, but we launched it on February 25th in Livingston. There was a small communities network meeting there, and we had 80 different people attend that. It was very well received, and we've gotten a lot of calls since.
Great. Well, our guest today has been Mike Dozier, the director of the Office of Community and Economic Development at Fresno State, which just launched the Rural Development Center. Also, Danny Brown joining us on the phone, the Economic Development Director for the City of Wasco, and Jose Antonio Ramirez, the City Manager of Firebaugh. Gentlemen, all thank you for joining us today on Quality of Life.
Always a pleasure, Joe.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Joe. Appreciate it.
This is FM 89. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment with a look at how volunteers are helping to ease the financial crunch facing many cities. You've heard of volunteer fire departments, but what about police departments? One Valley city thinks it has the answer. That's coming up next on Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. You're listening to a rebroadcast of today's edition of Quality of Life. When you hear the phone numbers, please don't call.
Support for Quality of Life comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
This is Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. My name is Joe Moore. Earlier this month, the New York Times published a story about the Fresno Police Department. It wasn't about a specific crime or allegations of officer misconduct. Instead, it focused on an emerging nationwide trend that finds volunteers, not officers, performing tasks from interviewing witnesses to collecting evidence. Our reporter Tracy Sharman helped file the following report for the BBC's program Americana, hosted by Matt Fry.
In this era of dwindling budgets and shrinking resources, police departments have been hit hard on both sides of the Atlantic. Just this week, officers in the UK threatened to march through the streets of London during preparations for the royal wedding, of all events, over proposed cuts in their pay, perks and overtime. Over here in America, 25% of all metropolitan police departments have reported having to lay off significant numbers of officers in the last 12 months, and many are having to rely increasingly on volunteers like Carol Borrego Lopez, who works with the Fresno, California Police Department.
Our cars still have the cages in them, and we've got the red and blue lights and all the bells and whistles.
We get dispatched to calls. If there's something out there they want us to do, they'll call us and ask us to go.
One day we were just going down the road, my partner and I, two to a car, and we saw a guy hitting a woman as we're still going past. This man had actually cut his arteries on his wrist, and he would have bled to death if it hadn't been for the fact that we saw him and got him help, even though he was the bad guy. And it's just stuff like that. It's like there are so many things that you could just see on a daily basis that you can help with.
Police volunteer Carol Borrego Lopez there. Her boss, the police chief, Jerry Dyer, says that he's been in the job long enough to see some significant changes over the years. We caught up with him this week in his patrol car on the streets of Fresno.
We try to place in the hands of our officers as many tools as we possibly can to allow them to do their job safely. A taser, a chemical spray that they utilize, handcuffs, and then within the vehicle itself, each of our cars not only have a shotgun, but a long rifle.
Chief Doc, give us a general idea about the crime situation in Fresno these days.
Currently, we're down about 4% on violent crime from last year. The challenges that we face, though, is auto theft and residential burglaries. Those types of crimes have increased dramatically. We have a jail situation in Fresno where people that are arrested for those crimes, unfortunately, are let out of jail very quickly because of overcrowding.
How much of a problem have you had with staffing your police force, given all the budget constraints, not just in your city, but in the whole of California, indeed the entire nation?
Certainly at the local level, we have felt it for the last 2.5 years. We have cut 25% of our overall personnel.
25%?
Yeah, about 367 positions within the department are no longer with us.
That's huge, isn't it?
It's very, very significant.
So how much are you now having to rely on volunteers to make up the shortfall?
Volunteerism has been the thing that we believe is going to carry us through this new phenomenon in policing in the new economy. In fact, last year, our volunteers put in over 20,000 hours.
Tell me about some of the risks and the dangers that you've come across as you rely increasingly on a volunteer force.
Well, there's always a risk involved in using volunteers, especially as you elevate their responsibility. But I have a saying, no risk, no success. The potential is for somebody to abuse their authority, that you bring somebody into your volunteer corps that does not represent your agency in a professional manner. Fortunately, we've not experienced any of that in the Fresno Police Department, but there is that risk, and that's what we have to be guarded about.
And Chief Dyer, what do the other officers, I mean, the genuine police officers, make of this volunteer force?
You know, when volunteers come into any organization, the potential could be for employees to start thinking that maybe their jobs are going to be replaced with volunteers. But we do not want to send that message, because I'm a firm believer that volunteers can never replace full-time employees.
On the other hand, if you make the volunteer thing work and you rely on volunteers increasingly, you're never going to get your original police budget back, are you?
I don't believe that we're going to be able to rebuild the organization as it was before. The reality is, until you're faced with a financial crisis, you don't realize how you can better provide a service for a lower cost.
And Chief Dyer, finally, would you say that your employing of volunteers to make the police force work, is that a model for other police forces around the country? Is that something that should be emulated?
We don't foresee the economy turning around in the near future. It's not about doing more with less. We have to do less with less, and then we also have to do the things that we used to do with civilian employees and police officers by other means.
Thank you very much, Chief Dyer.
Thank you.
That report comes to us courtesy of the BBC's program Americana, hosted by Matt Fry, reporting on Fresno's Citizens on Patrol program with reporting by our own Tracy Sharman. We're now joined on the telephone by a representative from the Fresno PD to tell us a little more about Citizens on Patrol. We have Sergeant Brenda Trobal on the phone. Brenda, welcome to Quality of Life.
Well, thank you.
This program is generating a lot of attention nationally, but it's not new. In fact, its origins date back a number of years. Tell us about how Citizens on Patrol came about.
Well, Citizens on Patrol came about 1997 as an extension, basically, of the Neighborhood Watch, where we were looking for an extension other than just your local block captains. And so as the Citizens on Patrol, with very limited tasks that they did, bridge the gap between the police and the community in a community-based policing type of style, and was able to enhance what we currently had as a neighborhood watch and be a liaison to the community.
Who are some of the people that volunteer? Not them personally, but tell us about the types of people that volunteer to be Citizens on Patrol.
You know, that too has changed as time has changed. You know, we've had people come in and stay with us. We have about four or five that were from the original group in 1997 that started. As time has gone, we have had increased responsibilities to those Citizens on Patrol, as we have the age and the type of person that is volunteering. We have an age range of about, say, about 23 to, we've got a few that are in their 70s.
How has the program grown in recent years?
Well, especially this last year, when the chief asked us to take that extra step and try to bridge the gap and be able to provide those services to our community, which the police department was struggling to do, we have actually increased, almost doubled the size of the Citizens on Patrol by asking the community to get involved and be part of the solution so that we can continue to serve the citizens of Fresno.
You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. Today we're talking about the efforts by Fresno and many other cities throughout the country to take responsibilities that were formerly the job of paid city employees, in this case the police department, and turn them over to volunteers. Is this a good idea? We'd like to hear from you, our listeners. Tell us your thoughts on the Citizens on Patrol program or other such efforts. The phone number is 559-275-8989 or 800-224-8989. talk@kvpr.org is our email address. And Sergeant Brenda Trobal joins us on the phone today. And Brenda, what are the screening measures that people who might be interested in volunteering for this program have to go through? And are you turning away people that maybe don't meet the criteria?
Yes, we do have to, unfortunately, turn away people who do not meet the criteria. They do have to go through a background investigation because they are around a lot of sensitive information here at the police department. So they do a background, and then they have to speak and write English as well in order to be a member of our Citizens on Patrol.
That's the requirements?
21 years of age, yes. So basically you can't have a criminal record in order to do this, and that's what the background eliminates.
And what type of supervision do these volunteers have in terms of their job performance? And as in any workplace environment, there's a chain of command and a structure that follows. What type of supervision do they receive from the department and sworn officers?
Oh, they receive a lot of training and supervision. The various Citizens on Patrol is broken up into five different teams. Each team has a team leader and assistant team leader. There is also a sergeant out in that district that is also responsible for them, as well as they assist and regular sworn officers throughout the shift that they're working, which helps oversee them. Then there is a coordinator that helps coordinate and supervises overall the program, and then myself as the sergeant supervises the entire program as well.
We're talking about Citizens on Patrol today. This program also has its critics. Some, such as the ACLU, have raised issues about the rights of defendants who may be charged with a crime, and in some cases the ability of volunteers to perform these duties equitably. And you've talked about the training measures. Is there a concern, though, amongst some in the department or some in the prosecutor's office that this may open up the door to legal challenges or other issues down the road in the criminal justice system?
I'm not aware of any concerns myself. And we try to take extra caution and extra measures in training the individuals who are our Citizens on Patrol to make sure that they have the appropriate training and resources needed to perform any task that we've assigned.
I have a list of some of the items and types of activities that these volunteers conduct throughout their volunteer service to the city, and some of them seem rather normal: traffic control and assisting community service officers when needed. But we also have things dealing with evidence and crime scenes, crime scene preservation. What exactly are these individuals being asked to do at some of those higher levels beyond just directing traffic?
Well, if you're talking about the crime scene preservation, they're on the outer perimeter. You know, you have an inner and an outer perimeter. They would be on the outer perimeter with the patrol car. Crime scene tape is across the street, and they're basically standing out there keeping traffic or pedestrians from going into the crime scene. So they are far away from that type of evidence. They're just on the outer perimeter of that, securing the roadway, for example, and that could be at a fatality accident or a wide variety of things. And then as far as the other evidence, they are properly trained, and they write the reports and document it just as if anybody else that was employed for the city of Fresno.
Have you talked to any other departments that have been inquiring about this program, how it's working in Fresno? I know there's other cities that are doing this. Mesa, Arizona has a somewhat similar program outside of Phoenix. Is this something that is gaining attention beyond just Fresno?
Oh, absolutely. I've received requests throughout the U.S. as well as international.
The report that we aired earlier mentioned the concern among some, or the potential concern among some officers, that volunteers may be taking their jobs, or jobs that used to be held by officers or employees of the police department that are not sworn deputies. Tell us about some of the concerns there. Has that gone over well in the ranks of sworn officers in Fresno, or has this generally been seen as an addition to services and preservation of jobs?
Well, first of all, we're not deputies.
My apologies there.
As far as sworn positions, they're not doing any of the sworn positions responsibilities. What they have been able to do is do some of the lower-end reports, which frees up the officer to handle life-threatening or in-progress calls. Now, the civilians that used to do those types of calls, those positions are gone. So it's not like they're taking away. At this point, we don't see those positions coming back. So we are trying to look for a way that we can still provide services to the community and keep our citizens safe by freeing up our officers to handle the higher priority calls.
I've been talking to Sergeant Brendra Trobal today on Valley Public Radio from the Fresno Police Department Citizens on Patrol program. Sergeant Trobal, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
This is Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. We'll be back with a look at other volunteer organizations assisting local government in crisis and emergency situations in just a moment here on FM 89.
Friends, this week, Valley Writers Read Wednesday at 7 features Coarse Gold author Evelyn O'Lang reading a delightful memoir, How She Came from France to America and Became an American Citizen. We learn about some cultural differences between the two countries, how Americans tend to be more casual than their French counterparts. She also recounts some amusing anecdotes about the problems she faced trying to understand some of our common slang expressions. For example, what was that grocery clerk trying to give her when she offered her a rain check or asked if she wanted paper or plastic? Or when that waitress wanted to know if she wanted her coffee here or to go? Evelyn's story is entertaining, enlightening, and touching. And it's all on Valley Writers Read Wednesday at 7. Join us.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of today's edition of Quality of Life. When you hear the phone numbers, please don't call. This is Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio as we continue our discussion of volunteers in the emergency realm, whether it's police or other types of emergency services. Volunteers are becoming an increasing part of the response to various crises and other situations. And we're joined in our studio right now by Yolanda Akers. She is a volunteer with the Trauma Intervention Program. Yolanda, welcome to Quality of Life.
Thank you.
Tell us a little more about what your program does, trauma intervention. It's telling us a little about the type of crisis that you're dealing with, but specifically, how are you coming to the aid of residents in need in time of crisis?
We provide immediate emotional support at time of crisis, and we're requested by first responders. So by law enforcement, fire department, ambulance companies, they're the ones that request us to go out and help families in time of need.
So you're talking about types of emergencies such as automobile accidents, fires. Tell us a little more about that.
Car accidents, we have been on scenes of those. House fires, when a loved one passes away in the home, whether it's expected or unexpected, we go in and help them for the first few hours until their support system comes in. We help them with phone calls and give them information as to what their next step is to continue on for their next journey.
You're a volunteer organization. Who are your volunteers? Are they trained professionals that are just volunteering their time, or are they just people who want to give back and serve the community?
They're all citizen volunteers. They all live in the local area. None of them, some of the volunteers have been volunteer fire department, so they have a little bit of more of a background as to what the emergency is. We have some volunteers that we've actually ran tip calls on, and they have joined us to be a volunteer, but they're all citizen volunteers. They go through a 60-hour training We do a background check. You know, we want to make sure that, you know, that they're going to be safe to be out in the public with the people that we are helping.
We also have joining us on the telephone now Barbara Swanson of the Medical Reserve Corps Project Coordinator for the Kern County Department of Public Health. Barbara, welcome to Quality of Life.
Thank you.
Tell us a little more about what the Kern Medical Reserve Corps does in terms of volunteers assisting local government and others in times of crisis or need.
The Kern Medical Reserve Corps is a group of medical, non-medical, and mental health professionals who sign up in advance to be ready to assist local government and first responders to help our community recover in the event of a local disaster.
And tell us a little about your volunteers. Who are the people that are saying, I want to be a part of this program? And tell us a little more about...
Well, our volunteers have to be 18 years of age and older, and we actually have a gentleman in his 80s, so we cover the whole gamut. And we respond to the medical side of disaster, but we need two or three non-medical members for every medical person. And in addition, we sign up mental health professionals because they're needed in a disaster as well. So it really is everybody. Everybody can join, age 18 and over, medical people, licensed and non-licensed, non-medical people, and mental health professionals.
In the past week, we've seen on television the dramatic impact that the earthquake in Japan had on the communities there. Disaster preparedness is certainly something that's a big issue in California with our threat of earthquakes and other natural disasters, fires, floods. Tell us about how your organizations would come to the assistance of the public in disaster such as an earthquake here in the valley.
Well, first of all, what we say to everybody, our members as well, is be prepared and be ready for a local disaster. Kern Medical Reserve Corps is one of over 900 units in the nation, and we're all linked together. We were started by President Bush after 9/11 because so many thousands of volunteers, mostly well-meaning people, rushed in to help, and it was disorganized. There wasn't any way to know who they were, what their background was, if they really had a medical license. And so this program was started by President Bush and put under the office of the Surgeon General, and Kern's is one of these units, and we're all linked together. So in a disaster, whether it was national or international, we're on the same notification system. We have the same basic training, and we are ready to assist each other, whether it's in our own county or outside of our county.
And Yolanda, your response, how do you prepare for a disaster like this and coordinate?
We would work with any local agencies would be setting up possibly an area for families to go, possibly like at the high school, living in the Foothill area, helping the Red Cross, being able just to give support to the families and just, you know, with everything that they're going through at the time. We do, you know, like I said, we work with the fire department and such. So we would come in and just provide emotional support for the people that they would be staging and putting possibly at the high school.
Has the economy had any impact on your ability to get volunteers to sign up and assist? Has it hurt or helped? I could see the potential for both or perhaps none. What's the impact?
In our local area, we really haven't had any difficulty with the volunteers. We have a small group, but we're in a small area up in the Foothill area. But we really haven't had problems with the lack of the volunteers being able to respond to calls or bringing in volunteers.
And Barbara, has the economy had any impact on your ability to find volunteers and assist the community?
No, I don't think so at all, because I think this program really responds to the person who really wants to serve and wants to help. Mm-hmm. And what's happening in the economy doesn't have anything to do with that. That's human nature. We have such wonderful people who say, yes, in a disaster, if my family's fine, my loved ones are fine, I'm not needed at work, you can count on me. I'll be there. I'll volunteer. And basically, that's what we like to do. We want to sign people up in advance. We're family-friendly, job-friendly. We need more people on our list than we can use because different things happen in people's lives. But I think it's this wonderful human nature that we see that people say, I'll help my neighbor. I'll help these strangers I haven't met before. Give me a job. I'm humble. I'm flexible. I'm respectful of all cultures. And I want to help my county, my community recover, because in a disaster, time is of the essence, and we know we have to help ourselves, and we just have to be organized and ready, and that's what this program does.
When we're talking about disasters here in Central California, forest fires, wildfires are a big concern. Turning to Barbara, I know last year, in last fire season, there were several events in the Kern County Mountains in the area of Bodfish and others that were very devastating to the residents who lived there. Many people lost homes. Was that the type of an event that your Kern Medical Reserve Corps came to the assistance?
Yes, absolutely. We worked in shelters and helped as needed, and it was fun. I mean, our people were calling me saying, don't you need us? Don't you need us? And I had to say, wait, and we get deployed in an organized fashion when they need more people. And sure enough, I got the call. So I put out the call to our members to be on alert, and they got back to me when they were available, and it worked. It was really cool. And people love to go in and work with the first responders and the medical community. And like I said, we need everybody. It's not just the medical response. It's the non-medical people who can run around and hand out water bottles and keep people calm, or direct traffic, or make signs, or do translation, or help people fill out forms. And the mental health professionals are needed as well. And it's fun to see everybody come together to help a community recover as efficiently as possible.
Can that enthusiasm be also a danger in the time of a very severe emergency in terms of organization and things? Is that where training comes in?
That's exactly right. That's where training comes in. We give people an overview to disaster response, and they learn very quickly the response that they're expected to give, and they won't be used unless they agree to that. And basically, they are just assigned a job. They're asked to do the job that they're given, to work closely with their supervisor, follow the chain of command, help the community recover. And so by training in advance the disaster response that everybody is using nationwide, it's a really concerted effort to coordinate a recovery. And I think it kicks in.
And Yolanda, your organization's training protocols, how do you deal with that sort of situation where you have a lot of people very eager to help, but coordination and organizing the response is a challenge? How do you deal with that?
Well, we have our volunteers that would provide whatever services that would be needed, and then we would be working with other agencies as well, such as fire, law enforcement, and we need to be a support to them and provide support in any way that we can, and have them kind of guide us in the direction that they need us to go.
We're talking about the threat of forest fires. We're approaching the summer season. It's been a very wet year. That often means a big fire season. Does your organization respond to those sorts of emergencies in addition to traffic fatalities and those sorts of things on the mountain roads?
We have been on a few fires that where they've had roads blocked off, or where families couldn't get in, especially during the summertime when you've got children that are at home. We've had volunteers that have been out at the roadblocks, making sure that parents knew that their children were okay, and giving them an update as to what's going on, and possibly assisting them getting into where their residences are.
You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. Today we've been talking about the role of volunteers in responding to emergencies and assisting local government. Our guests today have been in studio Yolanda Akers, a volunteer with the Trauma Intervention Programs of the Foothills, and on the phone, Barbara Swanson from the Medical Reserve Corps Project of the Kern County Department of Public Health. Thank you so much for joining us on our program today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. That does it for this week's program. For our announcer, Marv Allen, reporter Tracy Sharman, and production manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. Thanks for joining us. You can visit our website at kvpr.org for information about the program, hear audio archives, and to email us, that's kvpr.org. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Joe Moore. This is Quality of Life on FM 89.
Support for Quality of Life comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.